What's up, you guys? Welcome to The Imagination. I'm your host, Emma, and today I'm honored to have on the show SRA, mind control, and sex trafficking survivor and survivor advocate, writer and author of the book, Quest for Love, Memoir of a Child Sex Slave, podcast host and content creator, blogger, yoga instructor, educator, entrepreneur and creator of the Unconditional Model and Liberation Prison Yoga, and one of the most requested guests I've had on The Imagination, Annika Lucas. Annika experienced the greatest darkness in childhood through a series of events that led to her being groomed and eventually sold into sex trafficking, satanic ritual abuse, and trauma-based mind control behavior modification programming by her mother. After breaking free from the pedophile network that was trafficking her, Annika courageously decided to place her entire adult life into the context of trauma recovery. Her 35-plus year healing journey included much yoga and therapy. In 2008, she started teaching yoga, and in 2012 began training and organizing yoga teachers to enter into the New York prisons, which led to the founding and directing of the nonprofit organization Liberation Prison Yoga. Sharing yoga in the prisons, the unconditional model was developed. Since 2014, Annika has led many workshops, training therapists, yoga instructors, and others in the unconditional model. She travels the world to share her story and teach, including a 10-week online unconditional model course, Shifting the Power. Annika has a private coaching practice where she sees many survivors of extreme abuse and also hosts peer support platforms online. She currently has a workshop coming up on June 4th to 5th that I'm really excited to talk about today, and her book, Quest for Love, Memoir of a Child Sex Slave, is currently available for sale in America on Amazon through her website. I will have all of her links in the show notes. Annika's courage to shine a light on the darkness she experienced as a child has inspired many throughout the years to share their own stories and to not feel so alone. And her work with therapists and in prisons cannot be understated, as these two areas are in desperate need of education on trauma and recovery. Annika naming her workshops Shifting the Power couldn't be more appropriate, as she is a living example of shifting the power from dark to light. I'm grateful to have Annika here and ask that you all grab a pen and paper and give her your full attention. Before I finish introducing today's guest, I wanted to give just a quick reminder to email me at imagineabetterworld2020@gmail.com if you'd like to be on the podcast, and to subscribe to my free Substack at www.emmacatherine.substack.com. Thank you all for making The Imagination the safest space on the internet for survivor and whistleblower disclosures. So you guys, without further ado, please help me in welcoming today's guest of honor. Walking miracle, spiritual warrior, voice for the voiceless, and a woman who has been a personal inspiration for me and to this podcast, the one, the only, Annika Lucas. Annika, thank you so much for being here with me today.
Thank you, Emma. That must be the most amazing welcome I've ever had anywhere.
You deserve it and so much more. You've done so much and you've been through so much. I can imagine even for you, it's hard to compress it into a couple paragraphs. Your life is just filled with highs and lows, darks and lights, and everything in between. And I'm really honored to have you on today. And since you're new to being on my channel, and I have a lot of listeners and viewers who are sort of newer to a lot of this, I'd love to start by introducing you and giving you a chance to share your testimony. And I thought we'd go back in time to childhood or before childhood, if you wanted to talk about your family before you were born. And just give you some time to share what you went through as a child being trafficked through these networks.
Sure, I'm happy to do that. So I was born in Belgium, and my mother was single, and she was also mentally unwell, I could say. And so I was abused from the start. And my mother being single, this is 1963, so we're talking, it's a very long time ago, not at all a time when women were single. Mothers. And so she went to work, and I was with, I was placed in the communal daycare center. And the woman there was extremely warm and loving, and very much my real mother in those first years. So I did receive this love every day when my mother went to work. And I even have memories going back to the warmth and, you know, songs and so forth of that. That sweetness that from being seen as an innocent baby by this lovely woman. And it gave me, I think, a really big sense of self, that my mother, who was constantly projecting something that I wasn't, could never give me. So my mother married when I was three, and we moved to the, so, you know, we lived in Brussels first, and that is a bilingual city, and this caretaker was French speaking, and I started speaking French. Then my mother married, and we moved to Flanders, so she's Flemish. And I believe that we were singled out because of her mental illness, and because I was already abused, because I was already dissociated, and because she's obviously somebody who is not going to protect her child. We got a cleaning lady who was really a recruiter for the network. And she and her husband, you know, she came to work for us. And then that took a while before she then, I think it was a year of her taking me. And I never wanted to go. I never liked her. But I was forced to go with them a lot. And then eventually the man raped me. And this is like now we're talking just around my sixth birthday. And then I was taken to the first orgy with this couple, which was right away absolutely the most horrifying experience imaginable. It was in a castle. It was a mass ball. And I was used in an S&M kind of show on the show, on the stage, as, and the man that had brought me there, that pimp, he was also on the stage with me. Anyway, it was completely disgusting. That I stood up afterwards. There was a sense that if I don't do something now, I'm going to die inside. I stood up and I said, you can't do this. I'm going to tell all on you and make sure you all go to jail. But everybody was so high, I don't think anyone even really noticed. One man seemed to notice, but he sort of took flight. And then I was immediately threatened. I mean, I was taken somewhere by another handler. I was taken and immediately, you know, shown a fresh dead body. Just while he was very casually letting me know that they liked me, they didn't want me to anything to happen to me. So I immediately was given the message that I should never speak. This is only if I speak, if I say anything. I tried to speak to my mother anyway. I threw a tantrum the next time, you know, this cleaning lady asked to take me. My mother sent me back, but then later on, and I don't know how this happened exactly, but my mother became my pimp. So the cleaning lady stayed. She kept working there. But my mother was the one, she bought a car. In fact, she didn't have a car before. She took me to town hall to get her driver's license, which, because my stepfather was the mayor, she didn't have to do a test or anything. So she just got her driver's license, got her car, and she couldn't really drive. So, but she did, I think she got the car just so that she could drive me to the network and make that money. Even though I should say we were not poor. We were middle class. We were not poor. But my mother was really crazy in that way. And she had so much gusto. She really just wanted to be able to brag about the VIPs that I was seeing and that she then knew and she was talking to. She was really speaking to one person who is a countess, who's a contact person for the network. So she was very much, very happy to brag about that relationship. So again, my mother not being well, she was not the right, she was targeted, but not the right material really for the network. So she was never allowed into the network just because she was so happy to brag. I think that they might have thought she couldn't keep a secret, which was might have been true. So she wasn't really network material. So she was always on the outside of it and envious of me. And so 3 years I was a slave that was, a disposable, I guess, child. And it was, I felt it. So that I was only used in Belgium in the first 3 years. Certain aristocrats, which the network there was mostly, it was one man who was prime minister twice. I've named him, no one knows him here. And really was running the network together with some royals, but members of the royal family that nobody really knows. And he, but I didn't know that. I knew him. He was the big boss there in the network. And he was the one, he was a butcher. He had started out as a butcher and made his way up in politics. He was a very popular right-wing politician. And he, you know, did everything that is done in the network. That's to say, children were tortured, children were killed, children were indoctrinated. Although at the time, so we're talking 69 to 72, the methods they used were not very sophisticated. It was just him and, you know, it would put children in certain situations and, you know, not give them a choice and then make them do things and so forth, make children abuse each other and so forth, or very much the same sadism that is maybe something that you hear about from the network. You know, that as soon as you had a friend, you would pay for it. So, yeah. And then I was given to certain aristocrats who definitely, you could say that it was just pure chance that I survived. They could do what they wanted. Not all children did survive. I was also mostly, I was used for what they call the newcomers. That's to say adult men that are being indoctrinated into the network. That's to say it's a club. They want power. And they've probably passed several steps of their triage and then are now put in front of a young child. That is me, 6, 7, 8 years old. And that is being photographed or filmed in secret. And these men, you know, commit this crime. And now they are in the pocket of the boss of the network. And then 1972, I was given as a gift to what was an international networker, an American billionaire. And because the Belgians so much wanted to do business with this man, they gave him 2 children and they set up what was a classic, let's say, satanic ritual surrounding the Bilderberg meeting of 1972 in Belgium. It was in Belgium in that year. And so one of the members I was given to, and you know, I'm sure there was lots of children given to many members, but I and another child were given to, you know, for this ritual, where he was the guest of honor, and one child was to be killed and the other was to be raped. And well, I was sent with my little friend, that's to say a child who was a little bit slow. And so I felt extremely protective of him. He was also 2 years younger than me, but he was younger mentally. And I wanted to go. I think the idea was actually that I would be killed. But because he was a little bit slow, this American, in his eugenic mind, decided that the boy should be killed because he was slow. And I tried to hold on to him, actually. And I tried to offer myself instead. And that didn't go so well. And so that was very painful. And because he was complete, it was not, there are other children that I saw even, but because he was so innocent, it was especially painful. And of course there was my own guilt in that I felt, you know, that I had really tried to protect him. And of course I couldn't, but I took on that responsibility. I felt very, very guilty. And then through an absolute miracle, I ended up, this American took an interest in me. And that really was a miracle, that the moment that my friend passed, I was crying. And this American was looking at me threateningly, because children who cry in the network, they're not good slaves. And I could tell, even though he didn't do it himself, he had somebody else, a handler, rip this child out of my arms. And he had made the choice. But he thought I was crying because he had raped me. And I started to laugh caustically. I didn't care. I didn't care what he was going to do. I was just laughing at him, that he could be so stupid to think that I would be sad because he raped me when I had been a slave for 3 years, that I was not crying because of my friend. And as I was crying, it's like I felt the spirit of my little friend. I felt this lightness in my body, which was sort of his signature, you could say. And next, I felt this incredible force of love that was coming through me. And I saw this perpetrator through the eyes of complete love. And I saw all the pain. I saw everything that he had ever suffered that made him who he was. And I instantly understood that he had killed himself by killing that boy. He had killed himself. He had just died little by little every time he, as a boy, had felt slow. And, you know, there were other things, but I saw all of his weakness in that moment. And he saw that I saw it. And he thought I was sophisticated. And then this is all while I'm laughing. And the nature of my laughter is changing as we're having this, as this is happening to me, and he's feeling that there's something else going on. And so he took an interest, considering that laughter, he thought it was sophisticated. And also I explained myself, because I was in that state for a moment of this understanding everything and feeling that love. And then then everything changed for me. Once he took an interest and I became his slave. And so he did a triage. So first it was the blood. Then I didn't know who my father was, but my mother knew. And so I guess they asked her. But my father is from a French line of nobility and Cathars. Actually, the family are Huguenots, who are descending from Cathars. And in the mind control, I was actually trained with a Cathar grid. And that may not mean much, but some survivors may relate to that. So they knew my heritage, and they drew blood as well. I don't know what they did with it, but that was the first thing. And then I was in. And then I had the honor of becoming the slave that he wanted to create. So the next part of the triage was that I was sent to the United States. I spent time in various of his homes. And there he was doing triage and training. He was basically like a kindly father figure now, who was taking an interest in me that nobody ever had. He was seeing things that nobody had ever seen. And he was also training me sexually. I don't know if you're aware of the Kinsey scale. He was noting the time that it took me to masturbate. Well, he was masturbating me, and he was noting the time it took me to orgasm. He was writing it down because he was teaching me not to orgasm. I should just make it last longer and longer. He was touching me, and then I had to learn to not orgasm, because my pleasure had to be completely for the man, not my own. So that was happening. He was also raping me. He was also acting like a man who was in love. He was a real pedophile. And meanwhile, I was learning to eat foie gras, and I was, you know, learning to eat correctly. And I was we were enjoying lovely food. He could see that I had a good eye for art on his walls, and just loved hearing me speak about it, which was a gift that they were planning to use later on in the network. I know I was meant to pick out young artists because I had a good eye, and then basically bring them into the network. That was the idea. The training was at that time, there were a lot of things that I was receiving that I needed developmentally. You know, someone seeing my intelligence, someone teaching me, like letting me speak about art, and even teaching me about clothes. We went shopping on Madison Avenue. I talk about that quite a bit, but it was just so we went shopping and everybody was so happy to serve him. He never had to explain anything. Why a girl who didn't speak English would be with this American older man. And of course, it's expensive stores, you know, so they were just all over him. So happy to see him. He loved buying dresses for his slaves, I think. I've spoken to several other survivors who were also abused by him. And when he had a special project, he tended to buy clothes for them. So that was the beginning. And I was so happy, you know. I mean, I was already very split, but suddenly I was being treated much better than before. At least he was nice and people were very nice to me. And then we sailed to one of his houses more north on the northeast coast. And we stopped and spent one night at the house of a Rothschild. And it was clear that the Rothschild had to agree on the persona that I was going to become. And they then decided together, they made some decisions together, but it was clear that the Rothschilds must have made either a percentage on whatever, because, you know, he was going to make me into an elite slave, which means elite slave spy, and then give me a platform as a singer and actress in France, that that fame then would make me an even higher priced prostitute, basically. So in that first year, I was already sold to a man who was the chancellor in Germany. I mean, not at the time, he had been a chancellor previously. And I'm sure he paid a lot to have this child elite sex slave who knew exactly what to do and also took me around in public. And then while he paid for me, I was also spying on him. And then I had to report, and then I would report to my owner what his weakness was. And I did. I remember reporting it. I think, okay, so after my time with this owner, I'll call him my owner just to be clear, in the United States, I was sent to Germany, where a doctor who was basically working for him, a Nazi doctor, Hans Harmsen, who was at the head, he was the head of the family planning in Germany. So he was in charge of my mind control training. So I had my mind control training in a small facility in Germany. It was very specific, though, what they were doing with me. There was no experimentation happening. I was trained to, well, it was all torture based. So I was trained to recognize men's both their sexual preferences, their weaknesses. I was trained to kill in case that I should need that, and also for rituals as part being a slave who was part of the network now, instead of an outside child who was dispensable. I was trained to psychically to connect with men in their own mind and get them to fall in love with me. And for that, I was put in a water tank, a salt water tank, for days, I think, because it weightlessness apparently brings out psychic abilities. And so I was given instructions from this tank, what I should focus on. And first it was what I felt in my body, so that men were thinking to do things to me, looking at a picture of me. And then I would feel it in my body, and I would report what I felt. And then I had to transport my own spirit in a man's mind and manipulate him, fall in love with me. So to draw his thoughts to me and to create urgency, it's a very interesting thing. In mind control, I was trained to create urgency in the mind of a man, that so the way that he would fall in love with me would feel urgent and create it. You know, it's just very interesting how this urgency is a sign that there's something not quite correct. When you feel an urgency, if somebody is making you feel like it's fear, really. So anyway, I thought it was very interesting. I was impressed at how the mind control was transforming me. Because afterwards, it was just one month, the month of August of 1972 that I spent there. I spent July in the United States, and I spent it probably 2 or 3 weeks with this perpetrator. I spent it another week in a family near DC, seemed like a very middle-class family. But they were a satanic family, and they were all too happy, of course, to take care of me for a week. And I've actually met another survivor who saw me there. Because they were satanic families. So I was just put there for a week. And there was just some little details that he remembered that was very interesting. You know, that I had a very nice swimming suit that I couldn't swim in, because it was a swimming suit that he had bought me, a bikini actually, that he had bought me in that store, Madison Avenue, that was really indeed too pretty to swim in. So I had to borrow a swimsuit and things like that, that he remembered, but that I also, so this is someone my age, so that I also remembered. So after that month in Germany, I was very different. And the rebel that I was before, I didn't really find her so much anymore. I had heard so much what a fantastic life I was going to have. And I was being reeled in by promises of luxury, respect. And I was given extremely detailed descriptions of what my life was going to be like. And it wasn't bad, I tell you. I was going to be, of course, a star in France. I was going to have also, though, the best apartment, the best car. I was going to have the home on the Riviera. I was going to have the yacht. So these things were described to me a lot. And so it's something that I've learned rather recently, that, yes, they do need your okay, actually. And so I think that this was part of this. Apparently at age 13 is the age where you really have to, like, that's where you give consent. You know, the last I will, you know, there's five. But with me, it was a little different because I started later. And, but yes, I was being sold this dream life, and I liked it, especially because I had been treated so horribly before. So all this respect and everything, I was like, yeah, please keep it coming. I spent at least a week in a large basement in France with an entourage. So the entourage were, there was a facialist. I mean, I think I have some of my self-care practices from that time. I And it was all, it was, it's, and I'm still, of course, I'm not this persona, obviously, now, but I still have this similar, like, the idea was I should look natural because I was going to be the natural, sexy beauty. And that was how I was going to be trained. And I was being trained that way. So it was all about looking natural. So they did my hair, but then it looked natural. Or they did my, whatever they did, the makeup, it all looked very natural. And you can see that I look quite natural now. And I had a singing coach that was a famous French singer, composer. And he's alive. I don't really want to name him yet, but it's sort of the clan of Serge Gainsbourg. I don't know if you know him at all, but so there's a few women and a few men. And they sing these songs, and it's like children's songs, but they sing them so sexy, so sexy. And so while he trained me to sing, I was naked. Oh, important detail. I was naked the whole time that I was in this basement because I was to get used to the fact that my body is not my own, that my body is an object of worship, that my body is for the screen, it belongs to the public. While I was getting treated with, so there was a photographer, of course, and their pictures were taken, but nothing felt, it was never like the way it was in Belgium before. So I was treated as a goddess, rather a naked goddess, but a goddess all the same. And those people weren't particularly looking at my sexual parts either. They were just doing the facials and whatever. And they were taking care of me and they were making sure, it was the most comfortable bed. You know, it was a basement space, but it was enormous. And the quarters were very comfortable. I don't know where it was, but this coach, the singing coach would come. And so he would play the piano and he would, you know, he was teaching me. And then he was preparing me for a performance that I would do inside the network, which was classical songs, Jacques Brel, Edith Piaf. And while he was teaching me to sing, he was touching me sexually to so my voice would be affected and my voice would be more breathy and sexy. And he was clearly also getting off. And then at home, suddenly my mother sent me to music school. So obviously they told her. And I was, you know, learning music now. And on Wednesday afternoons, which was, we didn't have school on Wednesday afternoons. And that's what was there. That's what she found. She put me in it. So she was doing things as well. But I put all of that together later. And then I was practicing at home. I was practicing the songs. I was practicing the lyrics without any notes or anything. I didn't have a piece of paper or anything, and I couldn't read French anyway. I was Flemish, but I knew the practice, and I always had this memory and always remembered singing. I was wearing a pink nightdress and I was singing in front of my window in my bedroom, and my bedroom gave out, you know, there were kind of large yards, but there were neighbors on the other side, and apparently they had been watching me. And I visited them the next day, and they were laughing at me. Yeah, not nice people. It was the woman and her son, and he was younger than me, but they were laughing, and it was especially the mother, who was rather mean, and was laughing at me because I had been singing like for an audience the whole night. So it's interesting. I put that together later. So in this year of preparation, it was clear that I was going to be treated. They were selling this incredible life to me, but, you know, about a year later, the week before April 30th, it was sort of a week of festivities. It was in Italy. It was a villa that belonged to my owner. And so that's where I saw most of the royals, the celebrities at the time, famous actors, famous singers, Yeah. Many, many people from royal houses as well, politicians that were all there, that all passed by at least for various rituals and festivities, you could say. Really crazy stuff. And so at the time, so what I was doing, I would be given to men, and then I would go to my owner and I would tell him, I would have to basically report, what is this man like sexually? Like one of the men, he was very scary. And so what I had to report about him to my owner was that I would not be able to please him as long as I was alive. And so this information, you can imagine, for my owner was very valuable, because then he would give a dispensable child to this man, and then he would, of course, have him in his pocket. You see how that works. And, so many. I've begun to share, you know, who these people are. Obviously, there's many. It is feeling safer now. It is beginning to feel safer. Although, I for 1 second, there was a famous singer who, so I did my performance there. And that was going to be, part of this, all these celebrations. That was my coming out party, you could say. So now I'm 10 years old. I'm coming out for the network. I'm doing this performance, singing these songs. And I've had this choreography from this French composer, who was also there, of course. Or singer. He was known as a singer. He was especially known as a singer back then. He's also an actor. So I had this choreography that these are classical songs. And of course, everything was sexualized. So this is a beautiful song with lyrical and so for example, the text is in Ne me quitte pas, don't leave me, Jacques Brel. So the text speaks of the old volcano that nevertheless still spouts fire. So then I have to go sit on an old man's lap and look at his genitals. That's the old volcano, you see. That's still going to spout fire. And then there was a line about a barren field that nevertheless still gives a beautiful harvest. And I had to look at a woman. And of course, they're all pedophiles. So you look at a woman and it's a barren field, you know. So I looked at a woman, the one that I saw. I didn't really know what I was doing. You see, I just figured, I knew my instructions, but I didn't really know what that all of that meant. I just figured that out later on. So the woman was a famous singer who did not appreciate the joke because people laughed when, you know, when I looked at her. And that, and, you know, like jealousy in general, and I think something that she tended to do. She and her husband kidnapped me from that villa in Italy and took me to Monaco and did a very intense, first of all, they abused me and humiliated me, which was not supposed to happen, you know, anymore. That was not part of my persona. And so she could do whatever she, clearly my owner had nothing to say. She could do that. She did it. So they abused me, and then they did a ritual in a chapel, well, really a small church, which the royals in Monaco also use, where they did a ritual putting fire under my feet, under the soles of my feet. They had tied me backwards over an altar and put flames under the soles of my feet, and did a ritual that was an extreme exchange ritual where this singer took the purity of my voice, took the purity of my body, especially my chest, and I received her self-hatred. I tell you, it was powerful. It was very, very powerful. It worked. And after this woman realized that, oh, she could do everything she wanted with my owner, but she couldn't to the Rothschilds. So I was helicoptered to, this is Waddesdon estate near Oxford in England, which is Rothschild managed. And there, I guess she had to confess, you know, that she made an error because I was their product. And there I, it's so insane. But I was put in a park, and I was in a hunt, crossbow hunt. And so there's the panic of being a victim in the hunt, and then I was pulled out by Cockney handlers, or handlers with a Cockney accent, who then had me kill with a crossbow. They gave me a crossbow and made me kill a small animal. And their message, and it was so obnoxious, you know, it was so incongruous. Their message was, you see, you'll always be the victor. And I put together in the healing that, well, they humiliated me. They tried to break, you know, this persona that had been very carefully created over this year that was going to bring in a lot of money for a lot of people. Because, of course, that's why you're a star, so that it, you make more money for them. And whatever else, you know, whatever else you do. So they weren't supposed to break this toy. And so that was supposedly the training to put me back on top. That was their idea. Then I was picked up, taken back to Italy. And then I had to perform like the big ritual, which was my induction ritual. And I knew enough to do it because, you know, it's not like you have a choice to not do something, because it's going to be worse for the victim if you don't. So I did it, but I didn't want to. And so it was the time after that I rebelled against my owner. And then he started a reprogramming. So this is like when I rebel, I did not give my consent, basically. And now I was reprogrammed intensely to make sure that I would never be successful, to make sure that I would never speak, of course, but especially also that I would never feel that I deserved anything good. And so it was torture that lasted, extremely humiliating torture and imprisonment and dirty cages and dungeons and so forth. Blood and human remains to make me into that worthless creature that they wanted me to believe. And it worked, of course. And then I was hosed off. This building where this all happened was an official building in Germany. And my owner, I saw my owner there with a military person. And, you know, I just recognized him from somebody that you have had on your show. You put a picture out of this military person, and I saw them together in Germany in 1973. And I looked at his bio, and guess what? He was stationed in Germany in 1973. I saw that person there. He was not my abuser, but I saw him walk by the cage that I was in. So it was an official place on the top, and the ground floor and above. The basement had hanging cages, and next to my cage was a young man who was taken out of the cage. He was put back after being tortured, and he passed away. And then I was taken to the dungeons, and in the dungeons I heard the cries of adults. There were no other children there. It was adults that were being questioned and tortured there. In fact, I didn't see another child in that building. But that's where I was tortured for several days. Then I was hosed off. And then the Belgian handlers came and picked me up again. And then I spent one more year in the Belgian network. You know, and I guess that is the subject of my book. How I then got out, I got rescued by somebody from the inside. And, you know, I have my book here. I just want to show it briefly. It's called Quest for Love, and it's the memoir. And of course, it goes back to before and the mind control training and everything. But it is this last year in the network where, you know, a young man arrives who is just 20, and he then becomes my protector and then my abuser, and then ends up making a deal to get me out of the network, which then he did at age 11.
What a story. Oh my gosh. So many lives lived in such a short amount of time, and so many experiences that you had that were just so horrific to take in. You know, I've had people ask me, you know, like, when you hear these stories, does it ever get easier? And it's like, no, it doesn't. Like, they're just so beyond anything. Like, you could watch the most horrific horror movie, and like, it just exceeds anything that you could ever even try to imagine. Like, my brain can't even come close to even comprehending what these people do, you know? And then to think about learning about this as an adult, in a sense, and like reassessing it and trying to make sense of it from a child's mind. I mean, the work that you've done to sort of reverse engineer everything and put it back together as an adult is incredible. You know, the way that you've been able to look at your trauma and really analyze it, get to the root of things. And even that moment that you were talking about with seeing your abuser at such a young age with compassion. You know, I'd love for you to talk a little bit about that in general, because I know for me, for example, and I know that this happens with a lot of people, when you hear about this stuff existing and you understand it's real, the first reaction is just this hatred, this anger. You want to grab your pitchfork, go out and like take these people out, you know? And I still think to some degree that's kind of what we need to do. But I also see the humanity now through talking to survivors. I've never had a survivor come on my show and say, I wish that I could kill my abuser. They all say, I wish that they would heal like I did. I wish that they would come out and repent and heal just like I did. They deserve freedom, you know, and unfortunately, so few get it. But I'd love for you to talk a little bit more about that, because that's such a deep thought, the compassion to have, in a sense, for people who have gone through this. And how did that moment impact you through the rest of your life as you were looking at abusers? And obviously, you have your own podcast where you do the same thing I'm doing. You take in other people's stories and listen. How has that moment helped or assisted your own healing and how you look at all of this?
Yeah, that was quite a moment. So I don't want to take any credit for that moment, because, you know, that was a moment of grace. I had nothing to do with it. As I said, I was laughing sarcastically, and I would have been killed for that, and I didn't care. So that was where I started. And then I ended up having this incredible feeling, this love. It was as if love came from behind through me, and then I saw through the eyes of Christ or something. It felt Christ-like, that moment. That's how someone who's completely enlightened, that's how someone who has overcome the duality of the world, that's how someone who is completely rooted in that love and is not fooled by the delusion of earth, that's how they see everything. That's what I think it was. So I got that moment. So what happened with it was that my owner saw it very, very clearly what had happened, because why did he want to train me into? Well, I had to look at men's weaknesses, which is exactly what I had seen. And I had loved him in his weakness. He could see and feel that in that moment, I saw everything. I saw all his fears, all his childhood fears. I saw even how he felt really self-conscious about having a big nose. I saw everything. I saw all of his little, like, and yeah, he had actually been dyslexic as a child, I learned, and that makes sense. He felt slow. And he wasn't the brightest. the end of the day, trauma, you know, but I saw the abuse. And then there's this thing like there, but for the grace of God goes myself. Like, there are choices, but it's when you get very close, as we all do, to these perpetrators, we get so deep into their psyche that I think if we were to really try to put ourselves in their position, do you really know that you wouldn't do the same thing? The young man the gangster who ended up rescuing me from the network that I didn't speak so much about, because that's who I talk about a lot in my book, he used to do something. He used to kill people, and he talked about it to me, and that is also in the book. And he wanted to see people when they had a gun to their head. And he said that's when their truth comes out. And it's true. When you put somebody in a life and death situation, whether that was in Nazi Germany, you know, I know of a man, a Polish man who, under the Nazi regime, had a gun put to his head, and he was 20 years old. And either he was going to be shot or he was going to join the Germans. And he joined the Germans, and he made a wrong choice. And that man ended then becoming an impossible person, pedophile, and, you know, basically being a terror in his family. When you confront someone with death, you see their metal, what they're made of. And a lot of us never get into that place, really, to know. So the way that this trauma is inflicted on these children in the network, and that includes everybody who is an adult member of the network, it puts you in front of that situation. That's what trauma does. It confronts you with fear of death. And then the instinctual reactions to that fear of death, that fear of the loss of the body, these instinctual reactions of fight, flight, and freeze, those are harnessed. Fight, everything having to do with anger, that's an initial fight reaction. And that includes everything having to do with control. So you can see all these people in the networks, they're all in these, you know, those controller parts, you could say. The next is flight. So in the flight mode, you can run a lot faster than you can normally run. So in flight mode is how the super soldiers are trained, you see. These natural instincts bring out these superpowers that are not harnessed and guided in these new personalities that are created, those new alters that are created. So when you're confronted with death almost at the beginning of your life, some people even before they're born, because some of the training starts before birth. So can you really judge someone who doesn't have the strength and who never finds the strength? Because it's all fear. It's fear. How do you overcome fear? You have to have courage. So when I was 6 years old and I was confronted with the situation that I felt I'm going to lose my soul, I stood up and I said, "You can't do this to me. You know, I'm going to tell all. You're going to make sure you all go to jail." And this strength that came in me, that's not me. That's just like, that's the strength that comes from beyond. And that's the spirit. So the connection to spirit is the only thing that heals. And the connection to spirit is what gives you the courage to get out. But can you really blame someone who doesn't have that faith, who doesn't have that strength? Now, that doesn't mean that things don't need to be done, but thankfully it's not me that has to do them. That's not my job. Obviously, we can't let things go on as they are.
Yeah, you're 100% right. And that was a lesson when I took that in, it changed me because I was never taught that. You know, I just know people's actions. And I just like so many people in society, I wasn't taught about how trauma can affect somebody and about these abuse systems. And even just considering what, you know, somebody like your abuser and even you, you know, have gone through, it's changed every way that I interact with the world. You know, it's these seemingly normal looking people that have gone through this. And I try to just comprehend how many people I've passed in my life or said hi to, went to school with, you know, that I knew somehow or came in contact with or passed by on the street that were going through what you did. And like, I never even considered it because I didn't know, you know what I mean? And that's why your work, I think, and just these lessons, like it's so important for us to connect back with humanity. We're trained so much to just react everywhere we look. That's, you know, you look on the news and it's all these divisive battles. You look at politics, it's all divisive. Everything is made to tear us apart from each other and to look at beliefs, to look at an action that somebody did, but to never take a step back and put ourselves in people's shoes and ask that really brave question that you did. You know, what did this person go through before they did this action? What did this person's life look like? Did they ever have a choice? Do they have courage? Are they a coward in a sense, you know, and whether they are or not, you know, people can lack courage and many people do. Many of them don't have that courage that comes over them like you did. And I just think it's incredible that at such a young age, you had such a revelatory download in a sense come to you that's so profound. And it's something that most people don't ever learn in their entire lives.
Well, it has a lot to do with the trauma. That's to say, being faced with death does bring that out. And, you know, when that gangster talks about putting people in that situation and then seeing that they're cowards and then killing them, there's obviously huge projection of his own trauma and that he never was able to accept that part within himself. So obviously it's normal that we can't relate to pedophiles. It's normal that we can't relate to people who go around killing people. But see, the division is like this. Dissociation and division are the greatest tools of the people who want the control of the network that wants to, you know, centralize the control. And at the moment, you know, it's gotten worse, obviously a lot worse recently. But there's so much invitation. So it's like this, you get invited to judge. Always you get invited to look down on somebody, but for them, it makes no difference whether you think ill of elites, that's them, and you look down on them, or you look down on poor people. It doesn't make any difference. As long as you look down on somebody, as long as you participate in this toxic power structure by looking down on somebody. And you can say, well, of course, I'm going to look down on pedophiles. But yeah, of course, I do too. You know, like, it's hard. I'm not talking about all the times that I've wanted to kill them and that I want, you know, obviously, it's part of the healing is to go through all the feelings and, you know, the desire to kill and the desire for revenge. And, you know, all of it is part of the healing process. And it's nice to keep it in the context also, that there is like an adult present who can make wiser choices. It's so strong, this invitation always to look up, to give our power away to some and to look down on others, give our power away to, yet to a certain degree, those who are in power, because we do anyway, because we're paying our taxes, you know, and nobody wants their money to go to what the federal taxes are going to, but we're all paying taxes still. Until we don't, you know, we're all going to go along and give away our power to a certain degree because we're all part of the system. You know, you can go off the grid. You're still part of the system. You're still part of Western civilization. So how do you really participate in the problem? By projection. That's to say, if I'm going to assume, and that's the unconditional model, really, if I'm going to look up to someone and give my power away, whether it can be a survivor, you know, it can be a survivor, or it can be a sage, or, you know, it can be a guru, or it can be a teacher, or it can be people that you give your power away to. Like, I would give my power away to, you know, sort of women that are not good, right in the head, like my mother, you know, I would give my power away to women like that. Then that's, and as much as I do that, it's like a formula. As much as I give my power away, I will also look down on other people. So then I'm going to look down. I can look down on pedophiles. I can look down on those who want the power. I can look down on billionaires. But at the end of the day, we need to neutralize that. All is based in trauma. If I give my power away to someone emotionally, it means that there's like the face of a parental figure that is the hypocritical face of the parental figure that you had to love or else. Because if you didn't make them good, then what was going to happen? What if you didn't love from that place of fear? That's fear-based love. That's upward projection. And downward projection is that there's a part in you that you've not yet accepted, which is also based in trauma or unmet emotional needs. So if I'm judging, that's the smallest way in which you project out. That's a dark projection. And I don't mean judging like discriminating. I don't mean like, I can tell that you're a pedophile. I know. Don't tell me, you know, I can tell. But I'm talking about having this intolerance, you know, that there's this emotional intolerance for this person, that they're so bad. And of course, this is what's being invited a lot on the right now. Is this, but it's everywhere. We're all invited to take on a persona, whatever that is. We're all invited to like prove that we're good. You know, we're all invited to create personas. And on the other hand, when you're judging, if you knew, if you accepted that, that means that there's a part in you that you've not yet accepted, then you can go and look at yourself. And that's what the unconditional model does. So downward projection, if you look down on a pedophile, you say, well, I'm not a pedophile. I don't want power. I don't want to control the world, whatever, you know. There'll be something in you about that that is the trigger for you. So if, you know, obviously you're not a pedophile, but what is it? Do you get cold and unfeeling sometimes? Do you like power sometimes? You know, it's like you have to ask yourself the question. And that's the lens, I guess, of the unconditional model to heal ourselves in the context of changing the world.
Yes. One of the things that it reminded me of that connected with your story, when I first started waking up to all this, I think one of the first rabbit holes that a lot of people go down, especially here in America, is looking at Hollywood stars and celebrities. And you start realizing the symbology and the color patterns that they're wearing. And you realize that there's satanic imagery or words or messages embodied in these songs. And I think our natural reaction is to go post about it, which I would do. And I stopped doing all that for that exact reason that you were saying, because once I learned, now my heart just breaks for these people. Like, it could just make me sob forever thinking about, you know, even you being positioned to be the starlet. You have this beautiful life. You'd have all this admiration, all this money, all this fame, yet nobody would know the horrors that you were experiencing behind the scenes, you know? And so I think that these lessons, they're so powerful for us to look at the outside world and take that in, because we're so used to idolizing, and it does divide us when we go outside and we idolize without taking these things into consideration. And for people that are waking up to all of this too, you know, I hope that they hear your story and have that same compassion also for people who might be like you and placed into positions of entertainment or singing. Hearing the things that you had to go through to do that are just horrific, you know, and as society, we just see the end product. We see the star on stage, we see the show, we see the awesome performance, we get the record, but we don't get to see all the horrific things that they probably go to. Did you have any sort of, I guess, insight on that you'd want to share on that end for people to help understand? I know that you can only speak from your story, but I think that's really something that we haven't got away from, a lot of us, is that Hollywood type entertainment, like obsession or almost criticizing people who are, you know, they have the one eye symbolism or whatever it is that they're posting about.
Well, I think it's, you know, obviously it needs to be exposed also. And again, people do make choices, you know, so they're not innocent either. you know, even though a lot of them, when they're caught, especially, are going to be feeling like very much the victim that they once were, and in a certain way still are. But there's a tendency also to let the entertainers off the hook. But I was raped by entertainers too. And even at the time, I didn't think it was rape. But Eddie Arnold, for example, he was a big American star. So he was one of my rapists. And he's an entertainer. And people are, you know, from working with other survivors, all of my icons also have had to come down. I mean, I'm still disappointed when I hear about yet another one that maybe I thought, maybe not that one. That one. So it's so bad. And I understand that when there's a tendency when these icons are starting to fall, and we start to see the symbolism, and we start to see they're actually blatantly taking part, and they're signaling to others. So on the one hand, I have some compassion and understanding. And on the other, I'm like, hello, maybe now is, I understand it's difficult to get out also, but I also don't want us to like start seeing them as victims, because they're not just victims either. Certainly my perpetrator was not just a victim. Again, there's lots of choices that are made. And even though 13 is young, every day there's choices made. For me, that's the battle, is my own personal choices in this, I guess, in the yoga sense of making the right choice or the wrong choice every day. There's the delusion, which is the world and everything that comes from the world. And that the ultimate reality is not really to be found here. That the ultimate reality is one of love and glory. Well, that is wonderful. I've had a little bit of that experience, so I want to go back there. But that means to be able to overcome, you know, the unreality of the world. And that's a tall order. Then I'll be in that place of, you know, where I saw through the eyes of Christ. Well, I'd like to see through that place all the time, because that felt damn good. There's nothing wrong in that place. And then all the unreality of this, I think without that spiritual perspective of also the greater perspective of the unreality of these horrors, that yes, it's real, it's physical, it's happening. So yes, we do have to open our eyes to it. And then in the healing and also the experience that I and many other survivors have had, you know, while we were being abused, that's to say that the reality of these experiences are very different maybe from what they are perceived as from the outside also. That ultimately, the best we can do, and the first rule of every true religion out there is about behavior. How do we act? And of course, that goes back to not judging and not giving our power away, but being empowered from within. And for that, you really need connection to spirit. And that faith, it's like a muscle, you know, and I'm not talking about belief. I'm talking about experience. I mean, you maybe need a little belief in the beginning, but faith is like a muscle. It just, once you reach bottom or whatever it is that makes you get there, and that's what I pray for the people that are caught in the network, that they're going to reach bottom. That they're going to reach bottom and they're going to reach the end of the line of this downward spiral, because that's what it is. There's nothing enviable there. Then you have all these people with all their private jets and all their huge homes and all their servants and everything. And you're like, no, you really don't want that. There is no happiness in it. You know, just one roof is enough. And one little, you know, one mode of transportation is enough. That greed is part of this like very young I mean, that's what they've got. You know, that's all they've got. That's the, you know, you have to be greedy like a toddler. It's like a, I call it a hoarding complex of a toddler. Like emotionally, it's on a toddler level. And they're so good at presenting it to everybody. Like, that's it. Like, that's now you've made it, you know, because you're a multi-billionaire. I don't trust any of them. I don't trust any of them. Every time somebody is presented as a new hero, and it's usually a man, I think, I don't think so. That's probably a mind control slave, and he's probably on a mission. And they're so good at what they do, you know, give credit where credit is due. The network, they are masters at deception and manipulation. And the first thing for everybody to do is to understand that we've been fooled.
100%. Yes, that was a beautiful way of putting that, and so true. And speaking of, if somebody was newer to this and was asking somebody about it who maybe watches podcasts like yours and who has a basic understanding, how would you explain how this whole child abuse system network works to a layperson? Have you found a way that's been sort of effective to get that out? Because a lot of people ask me that. And I thought, of all people, you probably have a great answer to help assist us in waking up people who are new to this.
Yes. Yeah. But because the question, the first question is, how is it even possible? Right. And this is how it's possible, is that, and I know that mostly from working with other survivors, actually, I've really learned how the network works. So every town has its few members of the network. That's to say, they have a secret society. They have, or it's not so secret, but it's the highest levels of that society are secret. And those people form a local, would be a local chapter of the global network. And the local chapter on the smallest level, they may be satanic. They may be satanic, but with that, with their Satanism, that's to say with how trauma has deadened them inside, they keep the control in their town. That's to say, there'll be a judge, there'll be a lawyer, there'll be somebody in the police, on the police force, there'll be enough people so that when a victim starts to speak out, there'll be psychiatrists that when a victim tries to speak out, they can control it. Or when there's a case, they can control it. And then the way they operate themselves is that they will use their own children. So these are first incestuous families. And they use their own children first. So they traffic their own children. And then they use their own children. Like my mother, you know, my mother thought that I was going to marry a VIP. And for that, that justified everything for her. Because my mother's also a psychopath. She had nothing inside. She got all her value from external, from outside. So these people also, you know, part of the network, maybe born into it, maybe never left, or you know, anybody who's successful at some point may be invited, and then there's a triage that happens, and the person may not know that they're in triage, you know? And they may have at some point shown integrity and then not invited in ultimately, you know? And then not become successful, not become very big, or not lasted very long, you know? So there's all degrees. But so people that are in it, they use their own children. And then they will give their children to bigger networks with more powerful people. And that is how they themselves also get to climb or get, you know, power or whatever they want. They can have it, you know, on the lowest levels, the handlers and everything. I think it's often protection from the law. Why pedophilia is never, is not very well persecuted, you know, in the judicial system. And then those same children, depending on their gifts and so forth and their blood, they may be used in the biggest network. They may be trained. They are also triaged, the children are used for anything. People give up children that can be killed, like I could have been killed. And again, they come from families, you know, if they're network families with blood, they're less likely to be killed. If they're if they're kidnapped or if they come from the outside, parents that have sold their children, basically, well, then they can be killed because they need a lot of children to kill. So there's a belief system of Satanism, you could call it, or Luciferianism, or whatever it is really built around, psychologically, it's built around not ever, you know, looking at yourself. And so there's the belief that goodness doesn't exist inside of you, that innocence doesn't exist. So it's people who are afraid that their innocence doesn't exist, that if you peeled off all their layers, that you're just going to find an evil core. That's their training. That's their parents who made them believe that, or whatever. That's what they believe. They're too afraid to really look and find the innocence. So they're not connected to spirit. So they are going to be very much into occult things and everything because it's all about power. The occult is all about powers. Yeah. And you can, you know, while they're really good at poo-pooing everything that's sort of like not really spiritual, but at least psychic, that's because they use that so much. They use it. They know this really, really well. That's all part of how they use occult powers. So obviously we don't want other people to use it for good. They just want to ridicule it and make it seem like we're all crazy for believing in energies that are subtler than the physical. They want people to be atheists, but they are really believing. And that belief, though, all comes from this fear that they're evil anyway. So in a way, if you don't believe in the goodness of God, and if you don't believe in the paradise, if you don't have that experience of bliss, and you don't believe you can ever have it, and if you don't believe that you can innocent, in a way, this is Satan's world. You know, it's Satan's world in that the satanic in yoga, it's Maya is Satan. That's to say the delusion. That's Satan. And so the satanic force is indeed everywhere. Like, I'm looking at your body. I'm not really I may see some other things, but I'm not really seeing your I may see some light, but I'm not really seeing you. I'm seeing you in the physical world. I'm not, you know, there's a soul there and I'm not really seeing that. We're talking, you know, through our bodies. So if you really don't feel that you can be innocent and that you could ever be redeemed, then you might as well give yourself over to Satan and get power, because what else do you have? So the power gives you the false self-esteem. And there's the world. I mean, look at the pyramid of toxic power. It's all about, I mean, you know, about class, about money, about everything that comes from, that is external. There's a pyramid there. And you can place yourself somewhere on it. All of us fit somewhere. You know, there's a middle class. There's, you know, are you a woman? Are you a man? What kind of privileges? And those privileges, of course, are shifting all the time. So at any given moment, because of what they are doing, these privileges might shift. But we all have some privileges and we all have some non-privileges. And so we're all fitting somewhere. And that is the greatest invitation of the world to you know, a psychopath is going to be completely getting his value from that external system where people have more money, more power, are more important, and he will brown nose those people. And anybody who's below, they will just do anything, you know, that don't mean anything. So step on, walk over bodies when it comes to people below them on that power grid. And when that's all you have, then, well, there you go. Then power is all you have. So you use that system. It is completely immoral. But when you're trained like that from birth in that immoral system, or when, like me, I came later, but then I was used as a sex slave, and then I got this big temptation in front of me of like, now everybody's going to treat you like a star. If I can tell you without, you know, the experiences, without the connection to spirit, I would have gladly become that star. And who knows, you know, I wouldn't have, for a while, it would have been great. For a while, as a young woman, it would have been fantastic, you know, and then I would have been, of course, subject to all that these slaves are subject to. But I wouldn't want anybody to think of that person as a victim, because there are choices. We all make choices, and we can discern. We can have discernment, you know. Those are not, that those people are just like us, with weaknesses, except for they rise harder, they fall harder, they are, you know, caught more, it's harder for them to leave the system. But it is always the same. It's the world offers lies. And so those are the people that are most connected to the lies and are most going for the worldly. I mean, they sell their soul. They sell their soul for power. That's it. And power gives you everything. It gives you money. It gives you the drugs, it gives you the sex, it gives you everything, everything, everything. You can indulge in all your bad habits. And the biggest lie is that, the biggest lie that I think Satan puts out is that they get away with it. That's where they're all the fool. That they're not a soul, and that the soul is not going to suffer for that. I don't know if that explains it, but it goes to, you know, it comes, there's a lot of royals, of course, that are involved. And so they're maintaining this. And then it works through blackmail. You know, people that are just coming in, like I was saying, you know, they get blackmailed and they get triaged. So the men that I saw when I was 6, 7, 8 years old, I was always stunned. Like, I thought, why is he not like reacting? And that was because he had gone through a lengthy triage process before he was put with a child, so that they pretty much knew, we got this one. And if you have integrity, you fall on the wayside. And that goes for the children too. The children in the network, most of us survivors were those children in the network that had that strength. So they really want us, because if we fall, we can be very powerful in the network.
Thank you so much. That's a really important question, I think, because a lot of people get exposed to this information, say on TikTok, in like a little 60-minute video. And it's so sensationalized, where I love listening to someone like you bring it back down to earth and explain it in a way that makes sense. So somebody who's new to it can say, oh, well, I guess I could see my government abusing people and creating slaves to take out their dark agendas. Like, that sounds like something that could happen, you know? And we get so lost in society with all these different ways that, you know, the media barrages it, or entertainment presents it to us, you know? And it really takes these more down to earth grounded explanations to bring people back to how to explain it to people, to be effective in getting someone to understand that this is real, you know? Because ultimately, a lot of people don't still, or they don't want to talk about it. But it is very real. And I love your explanation. And one of the other things that I love that you've been talking about a lot is really the role that spirituality has played, you know, and we talked about that moment whenever you were young, where you had this beautiful spiritual awakening, almost, where in a moment you saw, you felt compassion for somebody who was just so awful to you, you know, that you could have just hated, you know, and somehow you found love for this person and compassion. I wanted to ask you about the role of spirituality in your journey, whether that was, you know, from that moment on as a child, if that helped you, and if you always had a spiritual connection otherwise, and then also in your healing, how has spirituality played a part in your healing and in your life?
Well, thank you for that question. Well, so I write a lot about that in my book, Quest for Love. And because I had a near-death experience that was actually more impactful than that experience, which, you know, I don't credit myself for at all. But the near-death experience, there was something that I did. And then I had the near-death experience. So there was a choice I made. It was a very dramatic choice, but it was a choice. It was not something that I wanted to do, but it was about helping in a moment, in a crucial moment, where I was actually on my way out and I was dying and I was very happy to, but someone needed my help. And it was made clear as I was already out. I mean, my senses had already reverted. And I made a choice to come back. Begrudgingly, because I really wanted to leave. This was when I was 11. This was the last day in the network. So I went and I had to help someone die because they were afraid. And I helped them die. And in that moment, I felt that incredible love. Also, you know, again, I was just an instrument to help that person pass, to reassure them that they would exist when they went to the other side, that they would still be, you know, that you're still you, you're still you. And after that person passed, then I had this incredible experience of like these, it was like these sheets of light that were all around me. And it was like, as I was lifted up into the astral worlds, and I had a glorious experience. I saw my guru. I didn't know these words, of course. I didn't even know if that was a man or a woman, but I saw this being that I knew very, very well. And so had this experience being in bliss, being in that love, especially it's the love. And at the same time, I also knew that this was more real than anything on earth. And that nothing on earth would ever be this real as this love, as this complete unconditional love, where you feel so blissed out. Nothing else matters. Sex doesn't matter. I can tell you that. It's more. So in the network, we get pretty close to these states, actually, through the drugs, through the violence, even through the sex. And I did too, you know, I was in those states, and they approximate the state of bliss. They get close. So that's what the networkers get. The bliss is more subtle. But the love is what makes the difference. And that love is the reality. And I think we're in this dual realm. There's fear and there's love. And everything is held together. The whole physical world is held together, essentially these forces. And everything can be tied back to one or the other. Everything negative can be tied to fear, and everything positive can be tied to love. And so this physical vibration held in place by these opposing qualities that are necessary for the physical world to even exist, then it's our task to align with love, to grow and to get to grow out of the state of human consciousness. And so having had that experience that showed me, among other things, showed me what I had to strive for. And it's the trauma causes the fear. Trauma causes fear of losing the body. And courage is the first spiritual quality where you actually do something in spite of the fear, not knowing what the result is going to be, not knowing that you're even going to live when you're in a healing process. When you go back to these feelings that are repressed, these memories, you don't know. Emotionally, you don't know that you're going to survive. You don't know that really, because your part inside of you doesn't know, because it's completely frozen in that moment of fear of death. So you need courage. You need courage to face fear and not knowing what comes next. And that has been, I was atheistic for a while. I was agnostic by the time I started therapy, and then I had to commit. And then that became the first thing that was greater than myself, greater than my ego. A damaged ego does not do well, is not really, you know, a damaged ego is either going to bypass, use spirituality to bypass and to not look at trauma, or it's going to be stuck in the trauma. And everything is spirit. So the healing is not possible. Integration is possible to a certain degree without a spiritual belief, for sure, without spirituality. But you're always going to end up in a persona. Because it's only, how do you really get out of victimhood? You can't get out of the state of victimhood completely unless you get out of every persona that is there for you, that is shown for you. Every persona, everything that you need to prove is something, a persona for the world. And again, my unconditional model takes the parental self as this self that is closely connected to spirit. And then you become the parent to your parts.
That's really sweet, because that's really what we all need, right? We need to baby our inner child. Everybody, whether they've went through what you did or not, we've all been subjected to so much trauma and just barraged with fear. Everywhere we look, there's fear. You know, turn on the news, turn on the radio, you go walk, you know, out in the neighborhood. Like, everybody's just in this really low frequency state, this fear state, like you said, this trauma state, you know. And I love that your work helps us go back inside and say, like, what nourishment and nurturing does my body need? Like, where do I need to heal myself and, like, go back and be the parent that I never had? And so that brings me to the next part. I want to talk more about your healing journey. I think that where you were, people hearing where you were to where you're at, I mean, it's just incredible. Like, there's no word more than miracle that I can think of to describe, you know, your transition, along with so many other survivors who have come out the other side like you have, you know, and just so accomplished in everything that you've done. So let's venture more into your healing journey. We talked a little bit about the spiritual side. Let's talk about the yoga and the therapy, if there was anything else that was really helpful for you. And then obviously we'll go into how those different things inspired you to create these books and projects and podcasts and everything that you're doing.
Well, thank you. Yeah, so 35 years, you know, it's hard to wrap up, but I certainly don't recognize the person that I was 35 years ago. That's to say, I was constantly in some loop. I call it trauma loops. People get into trauma loops.
Yes.
So there were parts, there were triggers. Crazy, crazy trigger. But again, it's in my book, but when I was rescued from the network, this gangster gave me a list of instructions, which I very carefully followed. That's why I'm in New York. That's why I moved to New York eventually. So these were instructions for life, which kept me away from prostitution and drinking and drugs. Very important, because at 16, I was already in the Red District in Antwerp. I would have definitely given into that, except for that I was not going to sleep with anybody. So it didn't quite work. And yes, those instructions were really my survival in the early years, but emotionally, I was constantly repeating situations and trauma and very private often. You know, it would be a whole story. The other person might not know what was going on. I was in an absolute state over it. Because I wasn't doing much in the physical world. Yes, I was promiscuous, of course. I was engaged with men, and I was definitely, and with friends too. You know, there were always these situations, and I call it trauma loops. You're in a trauma loop. There's a part that gets triggered that wants to complete its trauma by repeating the situation emotionally. The circumstances start to look like your emotional landscape from childhood. And so I was constantly in some sort of story where it's a persona, you know, whatever was triggered. It could have been the persona that was going to be famous was sometimes triggered. And there were moments where it seemed like that was going to happen, but then I was sabotaging it because of the reprogrammation. And there was the shame from the reprogrammation. So there were a lot of shame loops because of that. But I had no idea why. I did feel that I wasn't myself. So I was always able to write. I wanted to read, even though I left school at 15. I left home pretty much at 15, 16. So I left school then at 15 as well. But because I always wanted to read and wanted to study, and that was not one of the instructions, but I ended up going to American Film Institute as a writer, as a screenwriter. So I was accepted there. They didn't know I didn't have a high school diploma. I don't think you had to have a high school. Anyway, you could get in without a bachelor's, which I did, and that was just based on my work. And so the writing was always there. Like, I could always count on it. I've gotten a lot because of my ability to write, and I've always had a confidence around it as well that comes from nowhere. And so culture was very important, and therapy. I loved psychology, you know, even though I didn't really know much about it. I found a book, actually, to try to read it, Compendium of Modern Psychology, but I couldn't really read it because it was quite dense. I was 17 or something. And damn, I have to understand this. Like, I could not accept that I could not get it. Oh. So I worked on it, you know, and I got to get this. but I was always drawn to it. And so therapy was very successful, very, very early on. And that's to say, I felt that I knew nothing real. I always felt that there's nothing is real in my life. And then a few weeks into therapy, like, bang, crying as my perception was changed of something, some belief that I had about an abuser. And then suddenly, you know, I realized I was victimized, crying for 3 weeks. And as I was crying, I was receiving insights. And that wisdom, I thought, that's what I want. And that's kept me on the healing journey. Because if I knew what was ahead of me, I would have never. Never, ever. You have to be worried. But I did want to better myself. And I couldn't accept that I couldn't be myself, even not knowing who I am. So that I do feel now. I feel very much that I am myself and I do feel in alignment, but it's a very long journey. A lot of trauma stories, I can tell you that, a lot of trauma loops. And then, of course, after some time, I started being able to look at those trauma loops and get the distance, and, you know, with the help of therapy. And then I was doing yoga, which was so important because I had no awareness of my body at all. I was promiscuous, but I was just going to a persona and sleep with him. Sometimes I slept with a man I didn't even remember what had happened. You know, there was all this dissociation, was all there. So the yoga brought me back into my body. Very powerful. And then, of course, the physical results of sports and yoga, it was always sports too, just puts you. I mean, it keeps you healthy. It's important. It's part of the yoga is maybe the meditation is like, you know, that part of the yoga, the meditation and the prayer and the devotion. That part, you know, like for that, you need to be healthy. And anyway, need to be healthy anyway. what better way than to do a sport and yoga? So I don't take any medication or anything. I never did.
Amazing.
Got enough drugs, I think, in the network.
Yeah.
Yeah. Including little pills. It was all pills, you know, so I always avoided pills if I could. But it's slow. Healing is slow and it's annoying. You know, the world is not really conducive to healing. Work isn't conducive to healing. So I just happened to have the circumstances in which I could when I was married. And thankfully so, because I was in therapy every day and going to yoga every day, or going to yoga 3 to 5 times a week, going to therapy 5 times a week. Yeah, I was able to do that for a while. And I needed it. I needed it. I needed all of that time. And I did find a wonderful therapist who was like a mother figure to me. And then afterwards, she had to retire. And then, but she gave me enough of a, you know, I had the blueprint, I guess, from that person in my first years. And then I had the therapist who was really beautiful presence that ultimately come back to. The biggest breakthrough was in 2013 when I healed from a huge guilt complex that was always, you know, that was like a disease. The guilt complex really was a disease. It was like this. I was imbalanced, so I could do things that were not so cool and then not feel guilt over them, but then other things I would feel just tremendous guilt over nothing. So let's say that I would be just in casual contact with someone, little message, and they don't write back. And immediately I'm going to assume that they're not writing back because I've done something wrong. And I'm going to immediately make the interactions that we've had, I'm going to find some fault in myself to make sure that they are right for being, you know, angry with me. And then I might, you know, reconnect with someone like that coming from this place. And they're like, I don't know what you're talking about. So that's a disease, and it had to do with having to commit murder, and especially the last the exit ritual, you could say, from the network where I had to kill, which I describe, you know, in my book. And that guilt complex, like, there was a moment when I just wrote it out. I was just right. And the final puzzle piece fell into place and I just realized I finally could accept that I'd never wanted it. That was it. I never wanted it because I had these questions, but why did I do it? Why did I not say? And it's like, well, I'm strained that it's going to be worse for the victim if I don't. And I suddenly understood that. And without that peace, I could never forgive myself. I could never accept it that I'd done it. I was guilty. I was guilty. I was bad. And that last puzzle piece, like, I never wanted it. And once that sort of dawned on me, it suddenly, there was like a self-esteem that had come back. It immediately changed everything in my life. From appearances, it didn't look so good, but in fact, it was very good. It was very necessary. And I went public. I just did an interview for the prison yoga, and I just answered the question without like holding back. And that was it. That was the beginning of going public.
Wow. Oh my goodness. How did you feel after that? And what made you decide to keep doing it?
Oh, once I had that self-esteem, it wasn't a big deal. I felt protected from the fact that I was in the United States. And it wasn't much until 2016, a small video went viral. But no, it was clear once I started speaking about it that I should keep speaking about it. That was clear. And I would just do so. I never sought really to be interviewed. I just answered to when people asked. I just answered. And then in 2016, it went viral, and that was, yeah, then I got sort of the other side, confronted with, oh, the network is still extremely active, and they are sending people, and I better watch out. And then, of course, it's like, really? You're gonna like try to threaten, you're gonna threaten me? It was the same thing as in childhood. Like, why would a grown man or a grown person put so much attention on a little child, so afraid of a child? And it was the same now. I'm just a small person. What do you want? What do you want? So then it was more conscious choices of being public, and then also very consciously thinking about, in 2020, I really had to start thinking about my role. And I came to the conclusion that I'm sort of a 101 for people that are just waking up, that people that are just understanding, that may not
have any clue
that the world is not what it seems, that I would be, you know, an introduction. I can explain it. So an entry level for, and that's why I only talk about my story also, and I don't really share any other opinions or anything like that. To all the people, you know, with all the, whatever your opinion is, you know.
You're so brave to be able to do that, you know, and this was like years ago, you know, whenever you started doing this. It's hard now for people to accept this. I can only imagine back then. I know that you had a video go viral. So obviously there was interest then as far as people wanting to support and saying, wait a minute, is this real? Like, I'm going to watch this and I'm going to go share it, you know, and oh my gosh, I can't believe this. What have you seen sort of with the response from then to now? Are you seeing, I've only been doing this for a few years and I've already seen kind of like a shift. What have you seen? Just, you know, you've been doing this a lot longer than me. How has the landscape changed as far as how people receive this information?
Yeah, isn't it amazing how much it's changed? It's incredible. It's so hopeful. You know, in the beginning, it was like a lot of anger, a lot of disbelief, a lot of meanness. And of course, the networkers are always mean, but, you know, a lot of people just being mean for the sake of it. You know, I don't believe her, you know, she's like whatever, bad actress, you know. But it was sort of like a low vibration. Yeah, the comments were like either anger, like hang them, you know, we need to bring back the death, you know, penalty. And then, yeah, unbelievable how many people, and especially young people, are completely clear on everything. Beautiful people with so much clarity on the, every level, the spiritual level, the historic level. That's the responses. I feel so grateful. Like, I get these messages from people. It's like, wow, that's beautiful.
And I mean, you've had a big part in that. You and others that have stepped forward when nobody else would, you know, even if it was a confidence thing and it was beyond you, there's still a lot of people that could have been speaking out potentially and weren't. And I think that's what's amazing about what you've done is so many people have found their voice through you. They felt understood. People like me have found you and all of a sudden light bulbs go off. And it's like, oh, like I see how this all works now. Like she is explaining the infrastructure where before I might get a piece of it. Like, you know, trafficking exists, but it's like, okay, but how does trafficking tie into our government or the military or this or like the elite? You know, like there's so many disconnects in your story and how you're able to articulate it, I think has helped people. I think you're one of the first people that people find when they wake up. And I think hearing your testimony helps other survivors take the model that you present to them, that 101 model, and they say, oh, let me try to, you know, reverse engineer my life and try to fit my own pieces in sort of this model that Annika is talking about, which is so cool. And speaking of models, I want to talk about the unconditional model because I think that all ties into this too. And I want to talk about the businesses that you do because all of this, you talk about it on podcasts, but you go so much deeper into it and all of these healing methods with your work. So I'd love for you to talk about the unconditional model and what that is and talk about these workshops that you do because they're awesome and your book. I mean, I just want you to dive into all these business ventures because you give us a lot. You know, you've been a whistleblower for a long time, but you've also given us so many other opportunities and chances to learn, whether it's through books, workshops, podcasts, you know, and I just think you're brilliant. So talk about, you know, how you decided to start businesses, where you started with that, and share about all of these amazing things with people.
Well, thank you, first of all, for your kind words. Yeah. I should say that the prison work wasn't really a business. It was really a service that I just had to, at some point, I was just doing it full time. Like, okay, I have to finance it. And so I created a nonprofit organization that didn't really, I can't say that I made a lot of money, but it was very beautiful work. And in the course of it, I was, you know, first of all, going into the prisons, when you when you learn yoga, you know, like the way that it's taught and all those false gurus that are walking around and you know, and especially something where there's physicality and there's, you know, when I was doing yoga, when I started doing yoga, people would just come and, you know, grab your hips and they wouldn't ask to touch you. And it was creepy. There was a lot of creepiness. There was a lot of creepy teachers and men and women. And then I liked Ashtanga because Ashtanga is, you know, well, that was physically the sort of the most challenging. And so that's what I was drawn to. I sort of graduated naturally to Ashtanga. And you just do it at your own pace. So I like that. So you do the series and you come and do it in a certain time frame and you do what you do. And then, you know, you just advance at your own rate. And I did feel that a lot of people were survivors in that room. And then I heard about this incredible guru and then I should go to India. And then the guru came to New York and grabbed me. He molested me. Patabi Joyce. So I complained, but and then I wrote an article about it later, and it's unbelievable how that world also is just completely silent on all these abuses and, you know, speaking out about it. It's been horrendous, horrendous. And so I did the work in the prisons had to do with how are we going to bring yoga to people who are vulnerable by their situation, so vulnerable, and especially in the New York Rikers Island, you know, people, most of those people are there because they can't afford bail, really. You're just going to a poor area. That's really all it is. And I'm not saying that people shouldn't be incarcerated, but it was a socioeconomic situation there. So we're teaching, how are we going to help to feel people, you know, feel empowered? So there was this question of, you know, there's trauma-informed yoga. So there was that, and I was taking from that. But for me, it had to go farther because there was always this, like, I am the teacher and I'm teaching you trauma-informed yoga. You know, even though we're doing things differently from a regular class, we're not going to touch people. We're in a prison anyway. We can't. But still, I felt the teacher's always like putting themselves above. So how are we going to turn that around? How are we going to be on an equal playing field? And so that's the unconditional model. That's how that started, like trying to find a practical way to bring yoga. And of course, it was about presence. It's like yoga was the excuse to come in. And it was really bringing presence. We might not do any yoga. We might just like have to listen to you that day. You know, it was like that. It was very beautiful. Oh, I miss it. I don't do it anymore. And this is just, it's heart to heart. When you're heart to heart, you're on the same level. You don't speak down. But when you learn to teach yoga, you're taught to teach down. So that had to change. Like, and when you learn to teach trauma-informed yoga, it's the same. So just to completely be self-aware enough so that you can be on an equal playing field with someone. That's to say, looking at the ways in which you project up. Because you can go to prisons and you can project up to prisoners as well. Because through your white guilt, you might feel that, you know, you might feel that you're beneath the people that are actually incarcerated, or you may feel above people that are incarcerated because you're not, you know. So whatever it is, you know, it's like, how are you going to be coming from the place from your heart? And with good boundaries. So that became the unconditional model, is a way to look at yourself and heal yourself, whatever, using projections as a way in to your unresolved trauma, unmet emotional needs, and of course to be better present with others. And that can be anybody. It can be as a provider, or it can be as a friend. It can be as, you know, whatever it is for you, but it is to literally heal in the context of changing the world, in the context of undoing the toxic power structure.
Ah, I love that. I have chills going through my body. That's what healing is. You know, that's exactly what it is, like coming back. And then I love that you said that about yoga. I felt that when I would attend yoga classes, I always felt kind of violated by the teacher. I felt like they looked at themselves as like a master. And yeah, the touching, you know, whenever you're just trying to breathe and you're relaxing and this already sort of awkward poses that you have to do in front of people. And then they're coming over and touching you when you're just trying to like breathe into being comfortable in your body. It can feel so violating. And so I started doing yoga at home because of that. And that brings me a lot of hope that for you, like you're helping people understand how trauma comes into this and how triggering and traumatizing some of these things can be for a modality that should be very, very healing, you know, like the breath work with yoga and the stretching and the expansion and just being present with your body and in those moments. Like it's really healing if you're able to do it under the right pretenses with the right teachers and with the right intentions. But like you said, unfortunately, that industry, and my background's in fitness too, so I was exposed to it, the same with personal trainers. And it's just like a very egotistical industry for some reason, you know, when in reality, it should be looking at the people coming in. Like everybody does fitness to heal to some degree. Even if you're already in shape, you're trying to stay in shape so you don't get sick, you know, or so you don't fall into illness or disease. And somehow we forget that and it becomes like this very egotistical thing. So I commend you for seeing that and doing something about it. Because it was one of the things that like I detested about working in that industry was I was like, there's so many people that need help. Like a lot of the people that come to these classes are coming because they're insecure, because they're depressed, because they want companionship or they want to feel accepted. They want somebody to praise them and like be there with them, like on a level playing field, like you said. And it's very different than that a lot of times. And you know, I think it makes people fall even more into those insecurities that they have.
Definitely. And I work a lot with therapists, of course, because the model works on every modality. So I went to Prague in 2019 and taught groups of therapists. It was really nice because they understand really well. Yes. Either they want power, you know, like it's the power to be needed, right? It's the need to be needed. It's the therapist's need to be needed that messes things up. And I've seen so many bad therapists and so few good ones. So really bad, really crazy therapists out there. So there too. So I work with a lot of therapists and yeah, so the workshop I'm doing in LA in June 4 and 5, yeah, that is a live workshop. I love doing live workshop. I was doing them all the time with Liberation Prison Yoga in New York. And people are coming from everywhere, you know, to be there. And I just really, really love working with people in person. Last year, we did it in Holland. It was fantastic. And so this year in LA, where I haven't been in a really long time. So I'm really looking forward to it. I hope you sign up or just reach out with any questions about it. We have an accessibility rate also for people that have trouble affording it. And yeah, so this is what I love to do. The online course, of course, is more in depth. Those are more level courses for people that want to ultimately be an unconditional model practitioner, and which is the shifting to power, which you see there as well. And yeah, and then I guess there's one last little thing I want to say about my book that. My, you know, you were showing it earlier. So my book, yeah, thank you. So this is, right. So if you go through my website and you click on it, you'll go to the Amazon page that has it. If you go on Amazon, you won't find it because Amazon has shadow banned the search. So you have to go. So if you go to Amazon and you do a search, you won't find it. You'll find the Kindle. But you won't find the book unless you go to books in the search. Yeah. If you go, it is there, but you won't find it unless you know, normally when you do a search, it says all. You can't find it in all. You have to use the menu and go down to books, and then you can find it.
Oh my gosh, they're shadow banning you on Amazon. That is so horrible. Oh my gosh. Wow. And can you talk? I know you said that this is essentially a memoir.
Yes.
Can you just talk a little bit about this book and sort of what you hope people get out of it who read it.
Yeah, so, you know, I hope that what comes out of it, and if you want to click on this second image there, that is the back of the book. Oh yeah, it's hard to read, but it doesn't matter. It's the same as what is said there. Oh wow, you're good.
Here we go.
Yeah, so again, it's 101. Even though some of the things described in the book are extreme, of course, very extreme and painful, I hope that you get, first of all, the perspective of the child, which is different from what we expect. And also the hope, because I always had hope and I was always seeking it. That's the quest for that love. But I hope that even the peace comes through in the writing. And when you read the commentaries, you'll see it touches a little bit on that. You hopefully, I try to explain a little bit how it works in the book too, of course. And so it's weaved in with the experience and the spirituality, and I hope it's felt, even though it can be very hard to read. And I hope that the beauty of the language, because this is so important for me, and that's why I identify as a writer which is that I hope that the beauty of the language also helps you through it. The stuff.
And I love that ultimately your everything that you do, even though you use your story as the foundation, everything that you do is based off love and healing. That is like the final message that you want to get across to people, you know, and it's not about being a victim. It's not about, you know, dwelling on the things that you went through. It's about taking those things and giving your story a purpose, finding meaning in the things that you go through and being able to transform yourself with it. You know, and I look at somebody like you and I'm just in awe that you went through what you did and now you're doing things that most people who have all the resources, the time, the energy, who don't have, you know, a bunch of trauma that they've gone through and healed from, you know, anybody in the world could go write a book or do a workshop. And so few do throughout their whole lives, you know, and I find so much inspiration in this that you were able to find purpose in your pain and to be able to transform that into things that can help other people do the same. And your book is just one testament of that. I love these workshops that you're doing. Whenever you talk about the unconditional model, all I can think about is unconditional love. Like that's what comes to mind. And I'm like, that is totally everything that Annika embodies is unconditional love. So of course it would be called the unconditional model because it just really suits that. And you also do, people can contact you if they want to work with you, correct?
That's right. So I do personal sessions with people and I love it. I love working with survivors. So absolutely. Yes. And it's not just survivors. I work with other people too, actually.
And they can contact you right from your website, which is nice. She has a contact page. So really easy. And then lastly, I'd love for you to talk about your podcast because again, you have your own story that you harbor. You could easily just focus on your story. And in typical Annika fashion of taking on so many things to help humanity, you've decided to take on other people's stories and share them to help not only help give survivors a voice, but to, you know, increase the awareness of these different crimes that happen, these organized crimes. So I'd love for you to talk about your podcast too, because I love, you're such a good speaker and you're so meant for this. And I'm so happy that you're doing it.
Oh, thank you. Yes, so I just published actually an English version of an interview that I did in French with Chantal Fry, and that you can now get from my, and just if you scroll down, I think you'll see Chantal Fry there. Yeah. So if you click that now, you can get to the, you can get to the English version. You get the French, and then below that, you get the English, and then you get the YouTube and BitChute and Odyssey and all that. So I just recorded that with another person. So I'm just grateful to her. And next week, we'll publish the last interview I did with a male survivor, Alondra Markman. I'm very happy. I've known him for a long time, so I'm very glad that we sat down in person. I like to sit down in person if we can make it happen. So his story is, you know, again, very interesting. And yeah, so you get these different people. You know, my mission is pretty simple. There's the exposure, and then there's the healing. And so the exposure for me is, yes, like Ellen Wiele, for example, that I interviewed in Germany. She talks really about the process. It's very little about her history. She talks about the healing process that she's in the middle of. So, you know, it's like it's just the reality of having lived through that and the healing of it. It all comes together. Yeah. And I find that in person, I mean, it's obviously we can do it online like we're doing today. And I've done a few online as well. I'd like to sit down with people in person if I can. So, but thanks for asking.
You're welcome. I think it's amazing that you're helping hold other people's stories and holding space for them to tell it, you know, and knowing that you have your own story that you're carrying. I think it's so brave of you. And I encourage everybody, you can get to her podcast right from her website, which I would recommend. We never know if YouTube's going to keep this stuff up and some of these other platforms. And it's really awesome to just go right to the creator's website. And Annika literally has everything on here. So you're also on, I see at the bottom of your page, Instagram, Facebook, Telegram, Twitter. So you're also on all these other platforms also that people can keep up with you and connect with you. Telegram, I don't have access to on here, but I can see your page. And then Twitter, I love your Twitter too. You have been more active on there and people can sort of keep up with you day to day. You post your interviews and anything that's new. So Twitter, I think, is always a good place to just check in with you and see what you're up to and, you know, if you're doing interviews and stuff. And then your website is the wealth of knowledge for everything that you do, the book, the podcast, the workshops, the contact page, and your blog. You mentioned writing. Your blog, I think, is amazing too. You put a lot of tender, loving care in here with sharing photos and personal moments. So people can also get more insight into your life that maybe isn't in the book or that you don't talk about all the time. So Annika, I just really thank you for everything that you do. Cause I mean, I don't know how you do it. You find so much time to do all of this. I have a podcast and I do a little bit of writing and I'm like, oh my gosh, this is a lot of work doing this. And you're just out here, you know, workshops and books and podcasts and all this stuff. And it's really awesome to see. So is there anything, that we didn't talk about today or anything else that you're working on that you wanted people to know? Any words before we close up that you'd love to share? Anything that we didn't cover, I want to give you some space to do that.
No, I think you covered it all. I think you are extremely thorough. Thank you.
It's an honor to have you on. Like I said, you were a big part in my own learning and you helped really connect the dots and break this stuff down in a down to earth manner when it was so confusing to me, you know, and I know I'm not the only one. So I just thank you from the bottom of my heart for your courage to keep going. I know this isn't easy. I know it's getting easier because there's more people supporting, but you know, when you started, I know it had to have been a big uphill battle, you know, and you did it right in the middle of your healing too. So just thank you so much, Annika, for everything that you've done. You've given so many people a voice. You've given so many people courage. You've helped educate so many people. And I feel like you're still just, you know, right at the beginning of what's in store for you. So I cannot wait to see what else.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Emma. You're a fantastic interviewer.
And you are too. So people, please follow Annika. Go watch her podcast. She's the most compassionate, sweet, loving host ever. She has some awesome guests. You'll see some familiar faces too. She's had Rachel on and some of the other people that have been on this show and people that I haven't. So you guys will get to hear some new stories. Chantal, I think, is amazing. And Annika, you were featured on 50 Voices of Ritual Abuse, which I have covered extensively on this podcast. Huge supporter of that platform. So people can also go support you there. I'm going to have all of her links in the show notes. Go connect with her across all platforms. Again, we don't ever know where we might get scrubbed off social media or what's going to stick. So definitely go save her website into your saved websites on your phone or on your computer. Go visit it. Go watch all her podcasts. Connect with her. Lift her up. You know, the enemy still is striking. And so I always feel like the more eyes we have on survivors, the more protection it offers them, you know, and Annika really has been such a huge help to everybody. So go lift her up, everybody. Go support her. I'll have all my links in the show notes. Also, you guys, don't forget she has an amazing workshop coming up in June on the 4th and 5th. So please, if you guys want to sign up, I'm going to have that link also in the show notes. She has it right on her website. I'd encourage you guys to go support her. It's just 2 days. She can work with you if you can't afford it. If you do have the means to support it, it goes a long way to help support survivors' businesses. So please go support her. Go to her workshop. Learn from her. She's a wealth of knowledge. And just thank you guys so much for tuning in. We're so grateful for you. So you guys, thank you so much. And we will see you next time.